Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Now listen, you're listening to the Casterbras podcast with a K. Don't worry about other podcasts. Let them gawp, let them gape. Yes, did you know that we're available on Casterbras.com, iTunes, Stitcher.com and Audioboo? Well, you do now. Good, isn't it?
Hello. You're through to the podcast. How may I help you with your inquiry? Don't know what happened there. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the podcast with a K. My name's Christian Corley. And over there is a little guy with a funny beard called Brian. Hello, Brian.
Hey.
Hey, yeah. Do you still have the funny beard? Or am I just making things up?
I think you're making things up.
Oh, right. Okay. No, no funny
Damn
beard.
You.
Okay.
No.
And the other guy...
That would be funny, though.
Yes, wouldn't it? And the guy with the smoking jacket is James.
My name's not James this week. I want you to call me Cupcake.
Okay. You
done.
Okay. Why do you want us to call you Cupcake? Cupcake.
Because it associates with the cupcake that I have in my hand.
Right. I'd call my daughter Cupcake.
Does she have a cupcake in her hand?
No, she likes cupcakes.
Then that's erroneous.
Lot. And she demands that we call her Cupcake. Wow. As three-year-olds are wont to do.
I think there's a bit of a disparaging snark in that.
Quite possibly, quite possibly. Yes, possibly. Oh, I've got a little floating black thing in my cup of tea. Now, funnily enough, I had a floating black thing poured her in some
Karma.
Water the other day. And there's a floating little black thing in her water. And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "It's just a... Oh, God, what am I going to say to her? It's a Fred," is what I said to her. And now she thinks all floating black things are called Fred. So, be careful what you say to your children, basically.
Mm.
What have you
Not
been?
Exactly useful advice for Brian or James, but maybe to you, dear listener. If you tuned in last week, you'll know that James didn't bother to show up because he was busy directing a movie or something.
And, I was busy.
Yeah. And so there was just the two of us, myself and Brian Turnover, the two founding members of the podcast. Before we were saved by James's kind of Jesus Christ-like presence
on the show. Founding
this is
fathers.
Very true.
What's that, James?
I said the founding fathers.
Yes, yeah.
Mm. We didn't have a baby that was a podcast or anything like that, if that's what you're thinking. It's no. Not fathers like that.
No,
we wouldn't tell them, you know, that something floating in their drink is Fred, if that's what you're thinking.
Mm.
So we talked about the first half of Series 1, in celebration of Doctor Who Series 1, which is 10 years old this Thursday. And, you know, for that kind of massive anniversary birthday sort of thing, we should probably have some sort of drum roll, shouldn't we? I'm not sure.
Go on,
I don't. Well, I'm just looking through. Do we have a drum roll? I have no idea. Did we used
nice
to have
one.
A drum roll? Oh, well, no, we've got this, haven't we? So it's
I know.
Yeah, I know. So it's the, you'd think it was all stitched together in post-production. And some weeks, dear listener, it is. So, in fact, we've already play-tested this sound effect. So on Thursday, the 26th of March, 2015, it might be the date when you're listening to this, dear listener. It's 10 years since Rose first aired, 10 years since the return of Doctor Who. And it's been quite a fast 10 years, as 10 years go, because it's also 10 years since I wed later this year. And, that's a very slow 10 years, isn't it? Yes.
Awkward.
So you may have noticed that other websites are celebrating a little bit. Radio Times keep publishing things that they didn't have on their website previously, but had printed in their long-running magazine. They keep publishing those things. Did you see this, guys? I know we were talking before the show about Doctor Who Block 3, but we don't really know much about Block 3 whilst we're recording this. So we'll say, yes, Block 3's under recording, under production at the moment, but we don't know too much about it. But we do know that the Radio Times published a poll a few days ago, a reader poll, or visitors to the website poll. So we're not talking hardcore Doctor Who fans. We're talking people who watch Doctor Who as much as they maybe watch Call the Midwife or EastEnders or Antiques Roadshow, I suppose. And the results were quite interesting because there's only two Stephen Moffat era episodes or stories in there. And they are Vincent and the Doctor and The Day of the Doctor. The other 8 entries in this poll are all Russell T Davies era. Now,
that's interesting.
It is interesting. Now, I don't want to go too much into this because obviously we've got a lot to get through. But what does that say to you, Brian?
It says to me that his are better.
We're not talking episodes, we're talking eras.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of Moffat... I think the majority of the stories in the list are Moffat stories.
Yeah. Well, it's like I've said for a long time, his stories in Russell's era were better because he had somebody over him telling him yes or no. It's what he's lacking in his own era. In my opinion, and that even goes for Russell too, because Russell had Julie Gardner above him telling him yes or no, which is why his stories didn't seem to have as much issues as the Moff era stories do, because somebody was above them saying, "Nah, it doesn't make sense. Don't do that. Or maybe you need to explain that a little bit more." So I think that makes a lot of sense that those from the Russell T. Davies era would be in there.
Okay, James.
Can you explain it again? It's about eras, but it's about stories. I'm lost.
What happened was there was a poll of all these episodes. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they went up to a head-to-head or whatever like that. That pointlessly stupid tactic that some websites do. Readers of the Radio Times voted on these stories, and they compiled the top 10 of the best results of the top results. And in that top 10, there's only 2 Moffat era stories: Vincent and the Doctor and The Day of the Doctor. The other 8 are all from the RTD era. Now, there's some Moffat stories within the RTD era.
Right, I see. So, yeah, you're saying that the era, but the stories could be written by Stephen Moffat that are in that era.
Yeah.
Okay, that's where I was getting a little confused. I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting because I reckon if you did that poll, say, 2.5 years ago, it would have been a very different set of stories. I think they'd have been more recent. I think time changes things. I think it can be quite. It can go either way with time as well. Sometimes it can sort of create a more positive view, and sometimes the older stuff gets more positive, so that sort of glows a little more. I'm a bit surprised, to be honest.
Okay. Does
because all the comments I always see are always so very pro Stephen Moffat. Maybe that's fan sites though more than. Than actual, as you say, more mainstream viewers, because it's interesting. Because recently, something we perhaps should mention, there was on one of those websites. I think it was one of the cult TV or some wherever they are. They're all the same. That went through Stephen Moffat's era and explained it chronologically to explain the master plan. And again that sort of amused me because so many people in there say, oh, it's so amazing when you see his full master plan in effect, you see what it all meant when you put it all together. And you're kind of feeling like, yeah, but it's all retrospective. It's not done at the time. If it was a master plan beforehand, it'd be quite cool, but it isn't. And for mainstream audiences, they won't see it.
Yeah.
So obviously partially because it was never there until the very end. But, you know, to sort of praise him for it, it's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm pleased that he gave his era a structure and it meant something, the Smith era. But as a master plan goes, it was not there in the story for mainstreamers.
Do you think that the results of this poll and what you said initially concerning how it may have been different a few years ago, do you think this is... do you think it confirms John Nathan's Turner's dictum that the memory cheats?
I think it does, but then also current observation can cheat as well because your expectations are higher. As an example, I watched Rear Window yesterday.
All right.
The original James Stewart one. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't as keen watching it as I am today rewatching it.
Right.
So, in a sense, the being in the moment where you've got the pressures of expectations can sometimes affect your ability to sort of view the product in a sort of more objective way. Once you know what the product's all about, you can go back to it and you can see it in a different light because you've removed the shackles of expectations or concerns or whatever.
What was your expectation yesterday? Have you not seen it before?
No, I'd never seen it. It was one of those ones I'd never seen.
Right.
So... it's been sitting on my shelf for a while. And I thought I'd actually watch it. So
do you know
expectation...
the star of that film? The star of that film isn't the actors. The star of that film is the architecture.
Yeah, the architecture is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It sort of draws you in. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's a brilliant film. But because you know it's meant to be a brilliant film, on one hand, that can sort of create a pressure on the film,
mm-hmm.
and also the fact that so many brilliant films, you also go in skeptical, thinking they might be overrated. So there's so many factors when you watch something the first time that can affect it, and of course, excitement. You know, excitement factor. You know, people who watch Doctor Who on the day are very excited. So that can affect them, that they're not watching it objectively in the sense that their excitement is fueling whatever's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's just so many influences on a person as to when they watch, as you say, at the time to when they watch later. I think it's probably quite hard to say. But yeah, I think there's a definite difference.
Okay.
And maybe that shows in the mainstream. I think the thing is important to point out, as you said, this is a mainstream poll before people start saying, well, you know, Stephen Moffat's era was brilliant. You not know? Did you not know the master plan? Have you not seen that cult website where it's explained in full for those people who buy the DVDs and want to rewatch it all the time? Well, that's not really what he should be doing, should he?
Perhaps not. No. Hey, listen. We mentioned this a few days ago, so I should probably just ask James about it. Did you take the time to enjoy the eclipse?
I did, but meteorological decisions sort of decided I shouldn't bother.
Right, okay, same here then. Yeah, so basically last week we mentioned the eclipse that was hitting the UK on Friday a few days ago. And I said I was going to be going out to watch it. And I had planned initially to go up into the Yorkshire Dales. And it seems if I had, I might have actually, where I planned to go, I might actually have got lucky. But as it was, circumstances were against me, so I had to stay at home. And check it out in the garden, and basically got. I suppose the one benefit of it was that you didn't need to bother with any protective eyewear.
Mm.
Thanks to the cloud.
Thanks, clouds. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Never seen such a cloudy day.
No, I know. Almost as if it was intentional. We used to get a lot of clouds in the 1980s, didn't we? I also, and this is possibly
a lot of clouds in the 1980s. Yeah.
This is possibly the most lame attempt at a segue ever. But it was the 1980s where Rose and the Doctor landed in Father's Day. Back in 2005.
Yeah.
It's thank you.
Nice.
And do you know, this is one of those episodes that I do enjoy a lot, and I loved it at the time. I thought it was the best episode of the series. I think after watching it, and I was still in love with Young Quiet Dead at that point as well. And obviously, this is the episode.
Interesting,
which...
again.
Yes, well,
that you were in love with it then, as if suggesting you're not so much in love with it now.
No, I'm not saying that at all. But Father's Day had a lot of in it, and also it was Paul Cornell as well. So there's that kind of, for Doctor Who fans, there's that expectation of this being possibly going to be really good, because Paul had also obviously written a lot of the novels, and his own Ninth Doctor as well in Scream of the Shalka. So the Doctor and Rose travel back in time upon Rose's request, and she saves her father. I was nearly going to say accidentally or inadvertently, but she knew exactly what she was doing. She saves Pete Tyler from dying, and then the world is about to end, basically. So the format we used this time last week, James, was basically we'd discuss the episode a bit, and then at the end we'll give them some sort of... what did we do with the end last week, Brian? Did we...
The end?
Was it hit or miss?
No, we did. We chose rather than do a hit or miss, since we're doing a celebration of, we chose to do a moment of the episode that
moments
stood out
episode,
for us as a really good moment.
Yeah. So we'll do those.
So
moments.
Yeah, we tried to do it as a big celebration.
Yeah. So we'll do the moments of the episode at the end. But James, what are your recollections of Father's Day? And then whether you watched it, how you watched it.
I found it enjoyable yet deeply frustrating. I think it was the first episode where I really started to fall out of interest or love with Rose.
Right.
It was well written the way they did it, but she came across as too real in a lot of ways. There was a very strong sense of disharmony and a lack of balance in the two. There's that very pivotal scene where she turns to him in the flat and sort of basically says, "You know, I've got you round my finger. You know, I'll do what I want, and you'll come running." And it's a very cold and very teenager thing to say, And so it's very real. It's very well written. But it's sort of very... It called me a lot to the character from there on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's good writing, but it did actually damage the character for me. So that was possibly the only thing that I didn't particularly like. The Reapers... Yeah, they're okay. They were a bit video game in design, as if, you know, that sort of over embellishment that designers sometimes do.
Uh-huh.
But the actual, there was a lot of drama in there. There was a lot of feeling. It was nice to see Doctor Who being used to actually look at characters and the dramatic tensions between characters, which is really not something the old series used to do. The books had been doing it, and the audios. So I liked it for that as well. And that was very much Paul Cornell. So, yeah, and it was very poignant as well. It was very well done.
Mm, yeah.
I think as soon as you do a paternal thing, there's always a certain amount of poignancy there. You know, paternal to daughter relationship.
Oh, there's going to be, yeah. I always liked the relationship between Pete and Rose. They played into it a bit, didn't they? Because... it, with him having some sort of sensation that he knew her or something like that. But that's a potentially difficult area, isn't it? And I think they pulled it off really well. You don't just go back in time and... you know, you've got nothing to base it on, have you, going back in time and meeting your dead parent?
Yeah.
So they made it in whatever way possible. They made that believable. And there's some very good dramatic scenes in there as well. I notice it's directed by Joe Ahern, who I think we've established is... Eccleston's preferred director on Doctor Who, having also done Dalek and later did Boomtown, Bad Wolf and Parting of the Ways. Brian, your feelings on Father's Day?
You know, I honestly, I remember exactly how I felt, because at the time when I watched it, I did enjoy it. I thought it was a really good story, but I remembered thinking, I hope they never do another one like it. I felt it was one that somehow went a little too far down the serious drama path. And I felt, while it worked, it was a very nice story. It just seemed like it would change the base of what Doctor Who was to me. And I don't know. I felt also it was one of those stories that would work once. And then if you tried to do it again, you were always going to seem like you were trying to catch success again. And that's kind of why I felt it was better left as this one-off story. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I liked the relationship between Rose and Pete. I even like how Jackie played in it.
Yeah.
And I loved, well, I mean, we'll get there in a moment. But yeah, there were a lot of great, great moments within it. And I agree, the Reapers, they were better CGI than Slitheen.
Yeah.
So I probably give them a lot more slack. But I like them, I guess. You know, I mean, I guess they could have done a little bit more with them. And I think a lot of people have a lot of issues with stories that came after it because similar situations happen, and yet we never saw the Reapers again. But, you know, what can you do? As a story unto itself, I thought it was really good.
And, of course, Day of the Doctor absolutely screws up the Reapers, doesn't it? Does it? Does it? I don't know. Does it? Maybe it doesn't.
I tend to think of them like because they're sort of inferred to almost like the antibodies that clean up an infection. You know, depending, you know, it's a very complex system. As soon as you start comparing it to biology, there's not always circumstances where the same sort of antibodies will come in the same sort of way. You know, you can get round it. It's a different sort of wound.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too. Like there's ways to explain it, and I guess maybe that's what some people are a little.
Yeah, that's how I always looked at it.
It wasn't explained.
Yeah, that's how I always looked at it. I was thinking maybe Day of the Doctor screws the Reapers up a bit, but it doesn't really, does it? Because the Gallifrey is still out of the universe, so there still needs to be something happening. So we'll leave Moffat alone on that. That's okay. Listen, do you know what happened the week after? The week after.
Wait a minute. Charles? Are we going to do our favorite moments from the story?
No, we did that at the end.
Go on then.
So we'll do that at the end. We did. Yeah, 8.06 million people watched Father's Day. Incidentally, now the following week I went to my cousin's wedding, Stansted, in the Stansted area. There's a forest in Stansted, around there, and it was in the middle of the forest. A wedding. I didn't actually go to the wedding. I went to the reception. We drove down on the afternoon, and that evening, and it was a beautiful hot day, blazing sunshine. And the reception started, at I think it was 7:30. So we trundled in at 8 o'clock, having watched Doctor Who. Fortunately, all of my family had done the same thing. all branches and guests and people, most people turned up to the reception late, basically, because they'd been watching The Empty Child. They'd had the telly on, started watching it as they were getting ready or having a little snack or a drink or whatever, and found themselves absolutely entranced by one of the most surprising episodes of Doctor Who ever. Directed by James Hawes, written by Stephen Moffat, as you may well know, with 7.11 million viewers on the night. And this is the story and the reasoning behind why I want Doctor Who on when it's dark nights. Because I was struggling to see the TV set with the sun streaming in through these curtains, these light wispy curtains. Because we're in the middle of nowhere. When you're in the middle of nowhere, you don't need heavy curtains in the summer, do you? And there's all this spooky stuff going on with TV, with a child with a gas mask welded to his face, and Rose hanging from a barrage balloon, and meeting Captain Jack, this dashing, dodgy guy, and the Doctor having a mysterious phone call and telling jokes in the middle of it. Oh, it's a fantastic episode. I can't, you know, I'm going to have trouble picking a single favourite moment from The Empty Child. And then, you know, the week after, it was The Doctor Dances with 6.86 million viewers. For some reason, 150,000 people decided they didn't want to watch, or 250,000 people decided they didn't want to watch the second part. But there you go. You can't, no accounting for taste. I could talk all day about The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances and Square Guns and Banana Factories. Or is that the right way around? Whichever. Guys, Captain Jack arrives. Things kind of take a new direction. There's a bit of a gear shift in Doctor Who when this happens. In complete contrast, as was intended at the time, is when Adam joined a few episodes before, briefly. So Brian first this time.
That's it? That's not, no question?
Just speak.
How did I feel?
Yeah.
Well, Brian, I'll tell you how I felt. I really enjoyed The Empty Child. I thought it was a very nice, dark story. I thought it was a great concept, very well played on all angles. And I fell in love with Nancy. I thought she was a great character. You know, like, you know, Captain Jack was awesome coming into it, and I really loved Captain Jack. But, you know, after being fooled by Adam, as it were, I for some reason I just thought, like, this Nancy cool character, she's very cool. Like, she would make a very nice companion. So yeah, there was a lot to love in that story.
Yes, there is. There's an awful lot. And Richard Wilson's in there as well, isn't he, as a doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah. James?
Yeah, a lot of...
I can't really think of anything particularly bad or problematic with it to say. I think I agree with Brian, really. I'm a bit disappointed at myself, to be honest. I'd like to have something that bugged or irritated me a bit about it. But no, I think Empty Child is a very solid, hard to knock story.
And it's a genuine two-parter as well.
Yes.
Where the second part follows on directly from the first part, and the action continues, unlike, say, the Last of the Time Lords.
Yeah.
That two-parter, where what happens in the final episode is, like a year later or whatever. You know, I'm not saying there are no others direct two-parters, but I often get frustrated by the attitude towards two-parters in that they have to do something different with the second part. Why do you have to do something different with the second part? Just the only thing you have to do with the second part that's different from the first part is end it, whereas in the first part you had to start it.
Yeah, I think you just got to have a story which feels long enough to require
absolutely.
It.
Like
Aliens of London, I never really felt that it particularly benefited from being two. You could have probably made that a far more punchier one as one, to be honest. I mean, there's some nice scenes because there's two. You do get some nice scenes out of it, but it doesn't... Yes, Empty Child, The Doctor Dances flows pretty well.
Indeed. Well, we'll move on then, because we're going to come back to them all at the end and offer our favourite moments. Boomtown! Followed again with Jack now in the TARDIS after being rescued at the end of the Doctor Dances, and the three of them are in Cardiff refueling at the Rift, where Jack's probably actually underneath the TARDIS at the point they're refueling at the Rift, who knows, in his Torchwood guise. Ooh. In his parallel timeline, and they meet up with Mickey, and you know, there's obvious reasons why that's a bad idea for Mickey, really, the poor guy. And at the same time, they discover that one of the Slitheen has survived. And it's a return for Annette Badland, who's currently in EastEnders. Just thought I'd throw that in there. And she's a Slitheen who is planning on turning Cardiff nuclear and opening the rift to destroy Earth and escape back to her home planet. Not back to her home planet at all. She doesn't want to go to her home planet, but she does end up there at the end as a child reduced in size by the heart of the TARDIS back to childhood in order to be reborn as a nice Slitheen, or kind of a nurture versus nature kind of thing going on there. There's a vague allegory to that. Anyway, Brian first this time. No, James first this time. Brian went first last time. How do you recall Boomtown?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I never think it's as bad as people say, but yeah. it feels more like a almost like a prologue, doesn't it? Or some sort of breathing space in the middle of something, eye of the storm sort of thing. The comedy doesn't really fit sometimes in it, but obviously they felt they needed the comedy after the serious tone of Empty Child and Doctor Dances. I like the dinner scene. I think that works. Rose again suffers because, you know, you end up still feeling again for Mickey, which is funny because in Rose, Mickey is suggested to be a bit of a card. Bit of a dodgy character there in some respects. Yeah. Sort of some suggestions of him not being particularly faithful and everything. But by this point, I think you start feeling a little too much for Mickey, given that he's not the main character. But Captain Jack fits well into it. It's a shame that Captain Jack wasn't in more of them. I think that was always a big shame for Series 1.
Yeah.
I think Captain Jack with Eccleston would have been a really nice earlier sort of movement if they'd sort of done able to do Empty Child earlier and sort of had him in for more. But it's a flawed, but I don't think it's as bad as some people seem to suggest it is.
I've never really had a problem with it myself. I think the special effects leave a bit to be desired when the earthquake occurs, but I think it's well written. It's a tight episode. The script's good. The Mickey and Rose scenes, well, you know, you do feel sorry for him. Again, they're well written. The restaurant scene is really good. There's perhaps a little bit of a comedy with the teleportation bit at the beginning, which is maybe misplaced. I don't know, but overall, it's also brings in a very useful plot device for the finale in the form of the.
I was going to say, because a lot of people sort of, I remember at the time were shouting, screaming, and wetting their pants with anger over the Deus Ex Machina of suddenly having the TARDIS reduce her to a baby, but it works, as you say, as a prelude to a almost like a sort of Chekhov's gun sort of thing, more that, you know, that it's used later.
I wasn't actually at that stage. I was alluding at that point to the extrapolator shielding device that they use against the Daleks.
Oh right, okay, yes, yeah, so fair point. Yeah.
But we'll come to that in a moment. Anyway, Brian. Boomtown.
Yeah, Boomtown is one of those things that, to me, it's why I always say I prefer TV shows to movies. If you think about Doctor Who, if it was a movie series, everything would be pretty much the way we look at the series enders for every season. Like, the universe is always in danger. Yeah. The world's always in danger. Everybody is going to die. Whereas you can tell stories like Boomtown in a TV series if it's done properly. You can get into the mind of the villain, of the one character, and you can see that they're more than just that maniacal laughing villain. They're a person too, and maybe they chose a different path. So I felt the story was very well told, very well written, and it was a great change of pace. Certainly it was nice to have prior to the big series ender, where we were going to have all of that, the universe is in danger again. So I felt it was a very, very nice story that you would never see in the movies, I would think, in a series like this. But like James, I do agree that Rose was treated rather poorly. And I think, you know, we got threads of that all throughout series one, where, you know, she's all about the Doctor until she meets Adam and Jack, you know, and obviously, again, she's trying with Mickey, who is her, you know, I don't know, what do you even call that? The rubber band, the elastic boyfriend, you know, things aren't working here in space. But I thought, hey, maybe I'd see you again. You know, it felt really weird. Like, this is awful. Like, I don't know why I'm supposed to be endeared to you or why I'm supposed to like you. All of a sudden, I'm feeling like I'm not supposed to like this character. So it was the only aspect of the episode that put me off.
Okay.
Which is a shame, because you want the characters to be likable.
Sure. 7.68 people tuned in for that. Only 6.86 watched Dr. Dances.
7.68 people, huh?
Yeah, I thought it was
millions. Million, yeah, I did that last week.
I thought it would be a lot more.
Yeah, no, yeah. 7.68 million watched Boomtown. 6.86 watched The Doctor Dances. Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder how such an episode would work these days. It would probably end up being, based on Moffat's latest fixation, it'd probably end up being a two-hander between the Doctor and the Master, wouldn't it?
Yeah, probably so. But, you know, you also have Vincent and the Doctor, and I know he wasn't a villain, but they pretty much chose that story to tell somebody else's tale.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't see Moffat doing a Boomtown. I could see him, obviously, I mean, yeah, you're right, Vincent the Doctor, which he didn't write, is the nearest thing to.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's too freeform, I think. And I think it's interesting, the audience ratings, because I think this shows one of the issues with things like The Empty Child is that you see a drop-off between The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, and I think that's primarily because it's very dark material, and you might have children who find that show hard, while Boomtown, more people will be able to watch as an audience. Or, you know, the adverts will probably appeal more to a general audience, because everyone could watch that.
And the Slitheen are back as well, and both the Slitheen episodes were 7.63 and 7.98 million. So the Slitheen were popular with the younger audience.
Yeah, absolutely. You see an increase after episode one, much to the horror of Outpost Gallifrey, I'm sure. But
okay, so we move on then, dear listener, to the finale of Doctor Who Series 1, Bad Wolf, in which something that now occasionally, it depends how you're watching it now, it does in places feel a little kind of dated in terms of the shows that the Doctor, Rose and Jack end up in, Big Brother, Weakest Link, and What Not to Wear. Obviously, Big Brother is still going on. Brian, do you still get the Weakest Link in the US?
Oh, God, I have no idea, to be honest. I don't watch TV.
What Not to Wear, most people listening, and probably Brian as well, have no idea what Not to Wear is, and I'm not the person to tell you. Probably it's some sort of fashion show with two women, and hosted by robots. And it's a very interesting situation that the Doctor and friends are put into. Never put into any situation like that really before. Maybe, you know, the closest we're going is Greatest Show in the Galaxy, probably, or Vengeance on Varos. But in terms of what actually happens to them in there, we think that Rose gets killed. And we meet the Martha Cope's character, the controller, who's wired into the Satellite 5, which we return to from the Long Game. And then the Partner of the Waves with that big finale with the Dalek attack on the Earth and the Doctor and Jack rescuing Rose and the brilliant cliffhanger in between there. And everything ramps up and gets very exciting. And I probably still maintain that this is one of the best cliffhangers on Doctor Who ever as well, between the two episodes. And then there's that strange ending to The Parting of the Ways. I could sit here talking about these two episodes again for quite some time. I don't think there's much wrong with them. I think that Christopher Eccleston is absolutely perfect in them. And it's probably just a bit of a shame that that it's the end, really, hence the title, The Parting of the Ways. And, you know, at one stage, it could have been the actual end of the show as well, which is worth remembering. Brian first this time.
I watch this two-parter quite often, to be honest. I really like this one, mm-hmm. and it is one of those ones, almost in a sense, like you said, where the second part, while it is a direct continuation, is so much different from the first episode. Because the first episode was very much a kind of like satire on
reality TV.
Reality TV, thank you, jeez.
That's okay.
And while I don't, yes, they are a bit dated now, I don't mind that because they're relevant to Rose, which is what they were meant to be at the mm-hmm. time, which she's our window to the world at the time right there. And I like that. I like how confused everything was in the beginning where all the, and you get that. You get that sense when the doctor wakes up in the beginning and he's like, he's dizzy from the transportation and he has no idea what's going on. He's a little confused. And I like that. The audience was supposed to feel the same way. But I agree. I don't find much fault with the story. And like we spoke about last time, I really enjoy the use of the long game set making a return, much like the space station Nerva from season 12 in Tom Baker's era. I really enjoy that aspect of it. And overall, I felt it was very strong. I felt all the characters were well portrayed. I thought that the Doctor, Rose, and Jack were all used well. Even Linda with a Y was cool. You had some hope there. They actually made you like somebody before they killed her, and it worked well, in my opinion. So yeah, I think overall this is one of the best ones of the series. Certainly one of the best series enders, if not the best series ender. I really enjoy this one.
Okay, James.
Yeah, I think it's a really good end. I'm not so keen on Bad Wolf. I think when you do satire, you've got to be very careful how close you play it to topical, to pop culture, because it does date.
Yeah,
I think sci-fi satire works when you're a little less on the bone. So yeah, it does damage it to some degree, because at the time I felt the satire didn't really interest me that much, because it's very obvious satire and everyone was satiring reality TV. So it didn't really blow me away seeing Rose in The Weakest Link. It didn't blow me away seeing The Big Brother. And the concept, you know, these sort of things going into the future sort of thing you'd probably read in 2000 AD at the time. But it introduced some interesting characters. It was great to see Jack again, still having things to do. And it had a good ending. The intro to Parting the Ways is one of my favourites of the entire series, I mean that as in all the series. I think it's there's a great moment where, you know, and it's a shame they reused the clip for The Day of the Doctor, and My Next Trick.
Yeah, yeah,
is a really solid bit of moment for the Eccleston Doctor. The sort of the certainty and the sort of no messing. You know, when he, like Tennant, when he decides he's going to do something, when he wants something, he'll sort of kind of break the show rules, which is sort of what you feel he does when he rescues Rose. Mm-hmm. Sort of materialise in the TARDIS round her. You think, how many times could he do that to save people? And he breaks that sort of rule. So yeah, some great moments, good ending, very powerful stuff. There's nothing again. Some nice poignant moments as well with the emergency holograms, really nice.
Yeah.
Music's very strong. I had no issue. I suppose there's one thing I've got to say is I had no issue with the end. I thought that the resolution to Bad Wolf worked perfectly for Doctor Who. I think people who still grumble about that, I hope don't grumble at all ever about the Stephen Moffat era. Because, you know, the sort of timey-wimey-ness of what Russell did in that first series with Bad Wolf is nothing compared to Moffat's work. And if you can't swallow Parting of the Ways, you certainly shouldn't be, holding Stephen Moffat's work up so high, because they're the same thing. Yeah. Same character, same people doing the same sort of thing. And I think it works.
6.81 million people watched Bad Wolf, and 6.91 million people tuned in for the Parting of the Ways, presumably to witness the regeneration. Ah, yes, the regeneration. We're including the Christmas Invasion in our review of the 2005 series because it was in 2005, basically.
Fair enough.
So at the end of the Parting of the Ways, the Doctor regenerates in one of those moments that is... do you guys cry when the Doctor regenerates?
No.
I always cry. I always cry. And it doesn't matter whether I'm watching it for the first time or the 50th time. I always have a tear in my eye.
I cried with Wilf saluting.
Yeah.
Upset me. But
yeah.
I hold myself together for the actual Tennant death.
Okay.
But yeah, they are very poignant, yeah.
Yeah. So the Doctor has regenerated and the TARDIS crashes, and I'm going to sidestep the Children in Need thing. by the way.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, I don't want to go too mad on this. Yeah, so Doctor's regenerated and goes into some sort of induced coma, and the amazing Sycorax are attacking using some kind of blood voodoo sort of thing, and we're introduced to Harriet Jones, Prime Minister, who we'd previously seen in the Slitheen two-parter earlier in the year. And, you know, it's the beginning of the Christmas episodes. It's the beginning of the Santa robots motifs and all those kind of dangerous Christmas things. There's the attacking Christmas tree. And, you know, it's 60 minutes long, so it's the longest episode of Doctor Who we've had so far. And it introduces David Tennant as the Doctor who wakes up after someone spills some tea in the TARDIS. As you do. And then just basically sorts everything out. I enjoy the Christmas invasion, and I do like the Sycorax a lot, and I'm very sad that we've only seen them return in a single comic strip in Doctor Who magazine, because they're very good. They had a very good strong look, which seems to me to be something that on a budget-driven TV show needs to be something that you would reuse. But there you go. That's only my opinion. James, Christmas invasion.
Middling.
Okay.
I think the last third of it is really enjoyable. Tennant's very strong. The attack on Harriet Harman at the end is surprising and well done.
That's Harriet Jones, not Harriet Harman.
Harriet Jones, yeah, Harriet Harman. that's really good. I think I've said before, Tennant's performance in Christmas Invasion is so strong that when New Earth appears, he seems really weak and boring in comparison.
Why is that?
I don't know. They seem to really tone him down for that first episode. He lacks any sort of power, motivation, lines. There's just nothing that really grabs you. But that's in Christmas Invasion, yeah, he's really good.
I think the focus is on Cassandra, really, isn't it? I think that's why.
I don't know. Yeah. But the flow of Christmas Invasion is really... I think it takes a long time to build up. Strangely enough, I don't think the supporting characters hold it. I don't think Harriet Jones holds it. I don't think UNIT holds it. I don't think Rose particularly holds it either. It just doesn't hold that together. It needs someone. It probably needed Captain Jack, actually, to be honest. It needed someone like that to take it by the reins, so you weren't sort of just constantly waiting for the Doctor to wake up.
Yeah.
So very strong first half, not so good second half, sorry, not so good first half.
Average audience of 9.4 million, the Christmas Invasion had. Brian, Christmas Invasion for you.
Christmas Invasion actually is possibly my favorite Christmas special, in all honesty. I mean, I see where James is coming from, but some of the things I loved about it, and something I didn't even consider until sitting here listening to you guys, was it seems almost as if it was the base or a test run for Torchwood's Children of Earth, because we get to see what the Earth would do in a crisis without the Doctor.
Mm.
And I really liked that aspect, because usually when things are happening, the Doctor's there and we just see how he would settle it. And I also liked the fact that with Rose, we got to see that how much she relied on the Doctor and how much of her being the helpful, good companion that she was all throughout Series 1 was really dependent upon knowing that he was going to save the day. You know, like she probably in Series 2 would have had to step up her game a bit and realize, look, sometimes he's not always going to be there. And I think what it was she had him as a cushion in Series 1. She knew, you know, I can do these things, I can help, I can learn these things, but he's right there, he's got my back. And here was the first time she ever saw he doesn't have my back. I have to try and step up, and we get to see where she has no clue what to do. And I like that, because to me it's a little bit better than the companion who just all of a sudden jumps up and knows how to save the day, because why should she? You know, like, really, he did all the heavy lifting, and she did some great stuff, not to downplay the character. But I felt it was very realistic. You know, if you're faced with an alien threat that you've never met before, just because you've met a couple other ones doesn't mean you're going to know how to deal with it. So I thought it was very well done for her character. I liked the other characters that they introduced. I liked the pace and tone of the story. I remember initially being upset that the doctor only showed up in the last 20 minutes. But when he did, I agree the story did certainly pick up big time there. But I think that means the story did its job well. We got to watch a story without the doctor and what it would be like. And it wasn't as strong. It wasn't as powerful because of that. Not to say it wasn't entertaining. But the second he showed up, immediately it boomed. It lit up. Yeah. And it's the story that I always look at and I say, why did they ever think to do more stories without the doctor? Sure, Blink and Turn Left worked rather well, but why, if you see that, you know, the story kind of struggles without him a little bit, and certainly that was the point of this particular story, that it should struggle without him, why do more? I don't know. I really enjoy it. I really enjoy watching that story, and I know you didn't really want to talk about the Children in Need special, but I think they go hand in hand, and I think together, certainly you get more Tenant that way. I think it's a really nice, really well done Christmas special.
Okay.
So just Doctor Who episode, actually.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to the end of our summary of and brief discussion of each of the episodes in the second half of Doctor Who Series 1, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this week. But we're going to now declare our favourite moments from each of these episodes, from the Father's Day through to the Christmas Invasion. Brian, your favourite moment in Father's Day?
Father's Day, my favourite moment is I can't remember if these two are connected, but for some reason I feel it's connected with the Alexander Graham Bell phone call when the doctor realises what it is.
Yeah.
To the speech that he has to the wedding couple about an ordinary life and how that's all he's ever wanted. I really thought that was a beautiful speech. And I for some reason, I may be connecting them in my head, even though they're not. But what it is about the phone call, it was just a great moment, a doctor-y moment, doctor-ish moment that I thought was wonderful. But also, he sounds like he's losing his voice. And for some reason, it reminded me of the Android Invasion when Tom Baker lost his voice. And somehow, as silly as it is, it made it feel more Doctor Who in that way, that they didn't bother to try and like redub and fix his voice that way. Okay. So yeah, that speech, because of how great that speech was in that moment, because it had some kind of classic nod to me without even really actually being a classic nod.
Okay. James, you can just have a moment. Brian's just changed the rules there. Favorite moment in Father's Day?
Favorite moment, I think, is probably Pete's realization of his, I call it redemption, saving of what he's got to do to make things right. I think that's very powerful. I think that's always a powerful moment when someone actually has to take that sort of courage.
Okay, I think mine's probably more of a technical. Mine's around the TARDIS. I like the empty TARDIS, but I also like the key hovering in midair, holding onto the TARDIS effect, and like the whole idea around it as well. So that's mine. We'll move on to the empty child. Good Lord. There's a lot of favourite moments, and you know, we're doing the two-parter, so it's one favourite moment for the empty child and the Doctor dances, and I think mine has it's got to be Go to Your Room, I suppose. There's a lot of excellent moments in there, like hanging from the barrage balloon, and the Doctor's ad hoc stand-up act, and Captain Jack seduction of Rose and all of that. But yeah, I'm just the cliffhanger fixer, getting out of the cliffhanger, Go to Your Room, to the advancing gas mask wearers. James?
Yeah. I think probably the end of episode one is probably mine. No, actually, I think the scene with the, I can't even remember the name, the guy who's hoarding all the food.
Oh, right.
And the girl actually challenges her. I like the historical aspect of that scene.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That sticks out to me.
Yes, that is good. There is another strong scene in there as well, which might be Brian's, with there's the tape recorder bit as well. Brian?
That one's not mine, good. Although that is a good scene. for some reason, I'm sitting here trying to think, and you're right, there's so many in there, and the one that just keeps coming to mind is the sonic screwdriver, sonic or squareness gun. You know, he's got a sonic blaster kind of thing, and the whole conversation there, there's that silly battle where the doctor doesn't want to admit that his is a screwdriver, all the way culminating to when Rose has to stop them bickering by using the sonic blaster on the floor. That scene just gets me every time. I think it's a great moment.
Okay. We're on to Boomtown. I'll go. Who went first? I went first last time. Brian, you go first this time.
For me, it's Annette Badland. I think just her throughout the story, probably because they gave her so much meat to play with, and for a guest star essentially to have that kind of weight within a script is tremendous. And she had that beautiful moment in the TARDIS and I guess at the dinner table, but I believe I'm thinking of the one at the TARDIS where she kind of described her situation, even down to trying to make everybody feel bad for what they were doing to her. It was just very beautifully played. It was very, very well done.
Okay. James?
I think it's going to have to be the dinner scene. I'm going to just throw it in its entirety because there's some nice ping-ponging of attack defenses between the two of them.
I am inclined to absolutely agree with James. I'm just going to offer an alternative, though. I like the visual effects work on the Slitheen arm on Annette Badland when she's just got the arm. And also, I remember thinking this in Dalek, is that the same prop that they in Van Staten's museum?
Oh, right, yeah.
There's the Slitheen arm. I've been wondering whether that's the same prop that they use for on Annette Badland. Mm. Who knows? Bad Wolf, The Parting of the Ways. Brian first this time.
Oh, again? Cool.
sorry.
You're bad at keeping track. No, it's cool. I don't mind. Mine is kind of a visual effects thing with this one, because, again, there's so much within this story. And I really liked when the TARDIS materialized around Rose. They made such a big deal about it at the time, which obviously it's not the first time the TARDIS has materialized around something. We have to just look back to Logopolis for that. But the fact that we got to see it this time, it's a very simple effect because it's just the classic TARDIS effect, just seen from the inside, essentially. But for some reason, I remember just watching that moment and just being awed by it, despite the fact that I knew we'd seen it. It should theoretically happen. It was just seeing that it did happen. I remember being very taken with it.
Okay. It's one of those audacious moments, isn't it? It's very much like a comic book moment. It's one of those where it says, yeah, right, well, let's take this to a new level. And it's just really exciting, especially her reaction. She doesn't know what's going on, nor do the Daleks.
Sure.
And it's a real, like, yeah, don't mess with him. You think you can hit him with a few missiles? No, he wasn't even going down that route.
Yeah.
It's a really strong moment. Mine will be, that would have been mine, probably. But I think equally is quite strong in a different way is when she returns as Bad Wolf with Eccleston's reaction to seeing the TARDIS reappear at the last moment, sort of kind of a spine tingly moment as she returns to save him. So I might throw that one in there.
Okay. I'm kind of torn between two related moments to each of yours. There's the whole run up with the Discovery when he talks to the controller and realizes what's going on. And then there's that when it suddenly flicks to the Dalek ship and it's, alert, it is the Doctor. He has located us, etc. And there's also, which was my original choice, is the whole scene in the cafe.
Yeah.
With Rose and Jackie.
I think the only thing that gets me with that is, again, it sort of makes Doctor Who into a sort of like a European vacation backpacking.
Oh yeah, couldn't disagree with that at all.
And everyone else's lives is really boring if you're not doing that. And I always kind of think that the Doctor was, the whole ideology of the Doctor was the other way around, that you should just enjoy what you have. You should enjoy who you are. Who you are is special and important, and being what you do is as important as what everyone else does. That was sort of the message of the old show. Now it's sort of like, if you're not traveling with the Doctor, your life's probably boring, and you bet you wish you were. Because it's cool, even though you see lots of genocide, death, and horror. It's far better than living your life, just enjoying every moment. And so that's a kind of bug me with that scene. I think another scene I'll just quickly point out, I think, which was rather sweet at the time and confusing, was Jack's revival and then missing the TARDIS. Because at the time, it was like, you know, what does that mean? Oh, Why is he left? Did he know? Was that just bad luck?
Yes. All right, Christmas Invasion, then. We'll finish off. Favourite moment from the Christmas Invasion. I will go first, Brian Terranova. my favourite moment from the Christmas Invasion is... I'm going to have to go... I do like the Christmas tree thing, but I do find it a little bit... I found it a bit twee at the time. My opinion hasn't really changed considerably. But I do like the running joke, the Harriet Jones running joke, when the Sycorax do it.
Yes.
So I think I'm going to go with that.
problem is it only it gets better when it's done in series four. Yes. At the very end, right. With the Daleks, yeah. With the Daleks do it. It's the ultimate moment, isn't it?
Brian, next.
I am going to go with one of the ones at the very beginning, from the TARDIS crash all the way to David Tennant stepping out of the box, probably the whole intro sequence. And the reason being is because, number one, it was just a great visual effects sequence and a great moment to see the TARDIS flying like that. But I loved seeing the confusion after regeneration from the crash to the way that he reacted to Mickey and Jackie, which... I was so happy that new series audiences got to see the proper effects of regeneration rather than just make the change happen and carry on as usual, which was actually something I remembered being concerned about at the time, that they weren't going to portray that aspect of regeneration. Hmm. So I was very happy to see that they did, and I thought it was all very well played from start to finish there.
Okay. Do you know, I used to be very, very good friends with a lady who thought that the Doctor was just the same guy all the time. She is, obviously. But they just got different actors in. The whole regeneration thing was just like not a thing. They just replaced the actor.
You know, when I was a kid, that's what I used to think when I first found it on PBS, because they didn't often play the regeneration episodes. All I knew was one week I'd watch Tom Baker, the next I'd watch Peter Davison, and it was probably two different channels. And, you know, I'm remembering it weird, but
yeah.
I just remembered thinking when I saw Peter Davison, I'm like, that's not the guy with the scarf. Like, oh, I guess I got a new actor. But it made sense to my mind because that's what you did at the time.
I suppose.
You know?
So. Yeah. Okay,
but
James.
It's funny because for us, I mean, like when I was a kid and saw Legopolis and then Castrovalva was quite painful as a kid because they, in that very British way, they make it so clear because they have him unraveling his scarf, obviously, as you know, through the corridor. Yeah. And as a kid, that is almost like, you know, I don't want to use that sort of. It's like sacrilege. Yeah, that's his scarf. It's saying it's totally it's symbolic. And for a kid, even though it's sort of understated symbolism, it's very powerful. So it's like, this last person's dead. He's just unraveling him and moving on. Yep. So, you never got that.
No. So, James, your thoughts on the Christmas Invasion, your favorite moment?
Well, annoyingly, my favorite moment is the same as Brian's. Because I think I've said before on the podcast, when I was younger, before it came back, I always used to think if I did an opening to Doctor Who coming back, I'd have a TARDIS coming through a city like that, far more grand and expensive, and just crashing in a really big way. So to see it visualised in a sort of similar sort of thing was really exciting.
Okay.
But since he's taken that, I will probably have to say, obviously, Tennant's reappearance. I think probably the big red button was a very powerful moment.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is 10 years of Doctor Who celebrated right here on Casterbus with our recollection of its opening returning year. Thank you, James. In 2005, we don't have recommendations for you this week other than Doctor Who Series 1.
And Rear Window.
And Rear Window, then. Okay.
It is a good film. So,
It's a superb film, yeah. But, you know, if you're going to say Rear Window, then I've got to say The Watcher on the Wall from Series 4 of Game of Thrones. So,
well, you can edit that out because you don't have to say that.
Well, I've said it now.
I'll stick with Series 1 so someone keeps us on track. How's
good,
that? You
good
guys can
man.
Have yours. And I'll say Series 1, unless I think of something else in the meantime.
Hey, Brian,
I'll
do you remember
slot
that
in.
Do you remember that little one-page comic strip Anthony Dry did of the opening scene from Christmas Invasion?
Yes.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very good.
Yeah.
This stuff's always good,
It was, yeah. I wonder if I've still got a copy of that. I'll see if I can dig it out.
If you do, you should link it on the podcast.
I certainly will. I will link it into the show notes, dear listener, which are just below this podcast. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. So, there's me saying show again as if we're some sort of theatrical troupe.
I think we should take callers next time, though, like you did at the beginning. I think that would be fun.
We should see if we've got the hardware to do that. Yes.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. So until next time, dear listener, it's goodbye from us. And what you two don't know is that I was dancing to that.
Oh my God, so was I.
I really was.
Excellent.